This is Wildlife by the Numbers, a podcast about wildlife ecology focused on the proper, robust design of studies concerned with conservation and management of fish and wildlife. We hope to entertain and enlighten young and aspiring wildlife ecologists along with seasoned professionals. Our wish is to help guide the application of science in conservation. I'm Matthew Butler, and I'm here with
Grant Harris
and Randy Stewart.
So in this podcast, we're going to talk about sample size needs. So how many samples does a person need to collect to get a representative sample of the population? So it leads us back to this whole representativeness idea. So if a person samples too few, then there's a very good chance that person is going to include a disproportionate number of outliers, oddballs, or anomalies in the sample. And this is going to skew one's results such that a representative picture of the whole population isn't obtained. If the sample is too big, then one's work becomes too time-consuming and expensive to justify. So you're working too hard to get the answers you're after. So Randy, what might I expect for sample size needs for a relatively invariant population versus one in which there's a large amount of variance? For example, say a population in which the standard deviation is, say, two times the mean.
Well, sample size approximations typically follow the variance. So in an invariant population, the number of samples that generalize the population of interest will be much lower than, say, the one in which the standard deviation of the variance is much higher.
Now, Matt, when you and Randy, when you guys start speaking about this stuff, there's about four or five terms there that you use that I think we need to unpack just so that everybody's on the same page with what we're speaking to. And one that jumps out of my head is mean. So when we say mean, what are we referring to by the mean of a population?
Well, it's average.
Right.
I think everybody knows what an average is. You just take all the numbers, sum them together, and divide by your sample size.
Right, so if I had a number of 10, 20, and 30, that gives me 60, and I divide it by 3, so my average is 20.
Yeah.
We talked about variability. When we say the variability of a population, what do we mean by variability in this context?
How far away our observations are away from the mean.
So would a population say, so if we have our mean again of 20, and a population could have a variability of plus or minus 5, so you could have observations from 15 to 25, or it could be plus or minus 15, so you have observations between 5 and 35.
So variability is on a squared scale. So in other words, you take all those values and you square them. You take the difference of your value and the mean and square them. So you really can't think of it like it's plus or minus 5. That's why we have something called standard deviation, which is the square root of variance. And that puts it back on the same scale as your mean. So when you're talking about standard deviation, you might be thinking about plus or minus 5.
So from a variability perspective, we're talking about standard errors and standard deviations in the context of that mean value to represent a population.
You just brought in a whole other concept, standard error. Before we go there, let's think more about what variability is. And variability is described by variance and standard deviation. Those are basically the same value, just one's the square root of the other. And so we use standard deviation to describe how variable a population is. So how much difference there is in the observations from that central number, the average.
You know, Matt, I'm afraid that we're going to have folks glaze over on some of this, so we should define in a more clear and basic way what variance is and what we mean by standard deviation.
To define variance, you really got to think about formulas, which may make people glaze over more than us being vague about it. So to try to put a formula into words that people can understand, basically the variance is the average difference between your observations and the mean squared. So the average squared difference between your observation and your mean. And then standard deviation is just the square root of that variance. Now that we've put it in these mathematical terms, I'm sure everybody's asleep. So let's go back to that original question.
Hold on.
Man, you're not going to let me ask that original question, are you?
So if I have a mean of 50, and I have an observation of 60, right? I have a mean value of 50, and I have a count, say, of a sample of 60, I'm going to do 50 minus 60,
uh-huh,
which is 10.
Uh-huh.
Then I'm going to square it, which gives
me
100.
Uh-huh.
And then that value of 100 is going to go into my standard deviation calculation.
Right, and so you do that for all your observations. Sum them up, divide by your sample size.
Minus 1.
And that's your variance. And then you take the square root of that number, and that's your standard deviation.
Excellent.
And so, the only reason you're doing the standard deviation is because that original number is on the squared scale. Which doesn't really, you know, it's kind of hard to compare your mean to something that's squared. So you want to get it back on the same scale so they're not apples and oranges, but both apples.
Right. And all these formulas are covered in many books, but we just wanted to unpack that to show what we mean when we're talking about measures of variability. But Randy, you threw in a -1, and I know there's some technical reasons behind that, but so that people don't get confused, why did you put that -1 in there?
It's the sample size correction. It's the degrees of freedom. And you can find that also in the textbook.
You know, I guess another aside is people may be wondering why in the world you would even square it. And that's because if you take 50 minus 60, that's actually negative 10. And so you want to square that to put it on a positive scale. So now it's 100. And so if you didn't do that, basically your variance would always sum to zero or close to zero, and that wouldn't be very useful.
So bottom line is there are some simple and widely accepted methods to estimate variability, which would be standard deviation and variance. So if you're still uncertain about that, you can Google that, find it in textbooks, but they are relatively straightforward. But now that we have that established, now we can get back to your question, Matt. So thank you for humoring myself.
Yeah. So the original question was, what might I expect for sample size needs for a relatively invariant population versus one in which there is a large amount of variance? For example, say the population in which the standard deviation is, say, 2 times that of the mean.
Sample size typically follows variation. Thus, in the example with an invariant population, the number of sample size will be much lower than, say, for the 2 times the standard deviation being significant, requiring a significantly higher number of samples.
So if I knew my population was truly invariant, so that all the observations were the same value, how many samples would I need in that case?
So if based on your comment, you're saying that the samples generalize the population of interest, you would just need 1.
Right, okay. But we rarely know how variable a population truly is, right?
Right, and so In an earlier episode, we said if all the plants had the same number of tomatoes, we would just have to sample 1 of them. That was an invariant population.
Right.
But we also spoke to that some plants had 100 tomatoes and some had none. And so we have extreme variability. And so in order for us to get a accurate sample from that, we would have to sample more plants to make sure we had that variability well defined and understood.
Right. So again, we go back to that example of where it ranges from 0 to 100 tomatoes per plant. If we only sampled 2, there's a high chance that we're going to get an outlier. Maybe a sample of 100 and a sample of 50. Well, the average is 50, but that's going to, if we just take the mean of those 2 samples, it's going to tell us the average is 75. So we've got a really messed up estimate. And it's because we only sampled 2. So it's not representative of all that variation that's in that population that goes from 0 to 100. So this leads us back to that original question of how many samples do we need to adequately characterize this population? Clearly, if we have a population that ranges from 0 to 100 in the counts of tomatoes on a plant, and we only sampled 2, we're going to get some inaccurate results, and there's going to be very little precision in those results.
An important piece of that, Matt, in which you're getting at is, let's say I sampled 2 tomatoes and I got 1 count of 20 and 1 count of 50. And then Randy sampled two, and he got one count of 0 and one count of 10. And then you sampled two, and you got one count of 80 and one count of 85. And the true mean value would be 50. We would be all over the map, because we're just to reinforce that two samples wouldn't cut it.
Right. So we have really two issues here. One is it introduces bias. In other words, we don't get a representative sample. And so we need to increase our sample size to make sure it's representative and we don't have bias in our estimates. But we're also going to have a lot of imprecision in our estimates. So if we counted just the 0 and the 100 tomato plant, we're going to have a pretty unbiased estimate. It's going to come out as 50, which is a true population mean. But if we start thinking about variance, well, I guess the question now becomes, how do we characterize the variance in the population from our sample?
Well, before we go that route, it's important to mention that your mean may not be reflected in the small samples. Typically, with smaller sample sizes, your mean may actually be more reflected at the extremes, because smaller samples typically have fatter tails, so wider distributions, in comparison to samples that have larger distributions. So what you're going to see is potentially means that don't necessarily generalize or approximate the population mean, and you're going to have wider variation than so if your sample size is larger.
So Randy, just a bit ago you were talking about the distribution of samples. And so I have a sample distribution that imagine is a nice bell curve. It has a peak with very short tails around it, meaning from my sample, I have low variability around that mean. Imagine if I now pushed on top of that bell and I squish all my sample data out, I now have wider tails, longer tails, and I have more variability in data surrounding that mean. Because I have more data around that mean spread out, my estimate is now going to be more imprecise.
Basically, yes. So in the fewer samples, you're going to have more unusual observations, and you're going to have more observations that are possibly away from the mean. Whereas if you have a larger number of samples, you're going to have more samples that are closer to the true mean, and therefore the variation in your sample and the distribution that it's approximating is going to be more narrow around that mean. And this gets at to a few concepts that we haven't really spoken to thus far. You want to think about this concept in statistics that's called the law of large numbers, in which as the number of samples approaches infinity, so essentially you're saying is we get collect as many samples as that we want, then our samples will have approximate the mean of the population of interest. And then taking it a step further from the law of large numbers, we also have this thing called the central limit theorem that is incredibly important in the field of statistics. And that basically states that as the number of samples increases, we're going to now know of the distribution that it's being approximated. So we start thinking about this bell-shaped curve. As we collect more and more and more samples, our data will become approximately normal. So it's incredibly important as we think about how the number of samples will play into generalizing the population of interest so that we can start making statistical inferences about that population.
Matt, a little while ago you spoke to precision. What do you mean by precision?
Precision can be measured through something called the standard error, which is just that standard deviation, that measure of how variable your sample is, divided by the sample size. And that gives you kind of an idea of how precise your estimate is. Say your mean was 50 tomatoes, like we were talking about earlier, and your standard deviation is, say, 100, so it's really variable. And now I had maybe 100 samples. I'm going to take the square root of 100 and divide 100 by that square root of 100, so 100 divided by 10. So I'm going to say, well, my estimate is 50 plus or minus 10.
Now that we've established these baseline statistical techniques that we need to build from, we have to get back to the number of samples that we need. And as I understand it, and as we've been speaking to, the number of samples that we need depends on how much variability is in that population. And they're inextricably linked. Now, we can have hypothetically, and this does happen, well, it's not even hypothetical, it happens in reality. If we want an imprecise estimate, we can use fewer samples. And if we want a more precise estimate, we could typically get more samples, as Randy was speaking to earlier. But how do we know how many samples we need? Because in the end, when we're talking about Randy taking two samples and I taking two samples and Matt taking two samples and getting different numbers, we want to be able to sample a population consistently so that when we, either one of us can go out there and get an accurate representation of the mean value with an acceptable amount of precision. So how do we figure out how many samples we need, knowing that it depends on variability?
Well, if we know something about that population's variability, then we can, from that, determine how many samples we would need to be able to get a certain amount of error in our estimate, which basically falls back to that whole standard error discussion we were having a minute ago, which is that population standard deviation, or that sample standard deviation divided by the square root of sample size.
And we can typically use that information either through pilot studies or scouring the literature for estimates to be able to give us a very coarse sample size estimate using very simple sample size estimators.
So back to the tomato example real quick. So what I could do is go out and measure, say, how many tomatoes are on 5 plants, maybe 10 plants, look at how much variability I have, plug into those formulas, Randy, that you're speaking to that are within most textbooks on statistics, and say, okay, given this amount of variability, how many samples do I need to reach some level of precision that I want? That could be plus or minus 10, plus or minus 20 tomatoes from the mean. I can then go out and do the study with that sample size that I've now estimated from those formulas. And if I'm not happy with that precision estimate, I would just ramp up the number of samples, right?
Exactly. You should constantly reevaluate the number of samples that you need based on the information that you're acquiring from your surveys. And that, you know, kind of thinking more along the lines of long-term monitoring, when we start developing long-term monitoring programs and we set the initial sample size, that may or may not be the sample size that you need moving forward. Every year you should evaluate how the variation that you're trying to describe using a sample that generalizes to the population, how that's changing so that you can adjust to make sure annually moving forward that you're meeting your precision goals.
So depending on how much uncertainty you're willing to deal with, so how much imprecision you're willing to deal with, really drives your sample size needs. But that's very much interrelated to how variable the population is from which you're sampling. So you got to take both of those things into consideration. How variable is my population? And then how certain do I want to be? How much error am I willing to accept in my final estimate? Now, when we start to think about applying this to real world examples, we're usually not just like focused on, well, how many tomatoes does Grant have in his garden? We're focused on how more tomatoes in his garden than, say, Randy has in his garden. And so then we want to be able to compare those two estimates. And they're both completely imprecise. So Grant has 5,000 tomatoes plus or minus 3,000. And Randy has 4,000 plus or minus 3,500. We can't tell the difference between those two things. And that leads us into some more complex ideas about statistics and how we estimate those sample sizes. There's all kinds of formulas out there to do that stuff.
So Matt and Randy, we've been speaking for 15, 20 minutes about precision and the shape of curves and standard error and distributions and kind of getting into some rather complex statistical concepts that we really can't capture well here on this podcast. So why do we do that? Because in the end, what we're really informing people is that if you want to know how many sample sizes you need, back to this garden example, all I would really need to do is go out, measure a couple of tomato plants, see much variability I have there by plugging into one of these standard formulas that you mentioned to, and that would pop out a sample size to say, okay, if I want to have a lot of precision or low precision, that sample size will allow me to do that. So all I got to do is go out, sample some plants, figure out my variability, plug into some formulas, and go. So why did we go through all this dialogue about these terms and concepts?
Well, we went through that dialogue so people understand what's going on in the background, so they understand why those formulas are doing what they're doing, why what all these terms that people throw around when they're talking about sample size, like variation and standard deviation and standard error. Because if we hadn't talked about that, everybody probably wouldn't really understand much of anything that we were talking about. Yeah, just go get your standard deviation and plug it into some formula and move on. Well, okay.
Right.
Cool.
Well, exactly, because this sample size issue that you're speaking to, Matt, is actually getting back to our first podcast in which we're talking about representative. So when you think about sample size and power and variance and all of this, it's because our samples are trying to generalize the larger population of interest. And in order to do that, we have to take those same concepts from the sample to be able to understand how many samples we actually needed to be able to do it.
So in a nutshell, we have to go through that stuff so people understand what they're doing, what their results mean, and how to interpret that, and to help make sure that they're getting the results that they want and that their sample is going to represent the amount of precision that they want as a result.
But there's really no hard sample size estimate. Typically, what one should think of is more the better, and that's because if we start thinking about those very narrow peaks, those skinnier tails compared to fatter tails, unusual observations compared to more observations that are around the mean, what we're really thinking of is one needs to collect more, and there are some methodologies that one could do, such as conducting the pilot studies that we've sort of been mentioning, or scouring the literature for parameter estimates that's going to be able to give us a general idea or a coarse estimate of a sample size estimation. But when we think about biologists that are currently developing their biological program, sometimes it's a stretch. It can be very difficult to think about investing those resources to conduct a pilot study. So therefore, they're now blindly sampling their population of interest, not knowing whether or not the samples are enough. And thus the concepts that we've been talking about thus far are going to be incredibly important if a pilot study is ignored, or if they've been doing or implementing a long-term monitoring program blindly, but also in good faith of trying to effectively monitor those populations.
So a pilot study is just a pre-study that we're talking about, just going out and getting some preliminary data to figure out what your sample size is. But Randy, to me, that sounds like such a simple, sensible thing to do. Do you really get people giving you pushback about pilot studies?
Yes, you know, I've been involved writing a book chapter about these exact concepts. It's been shared with me that either due to financial constraints or logistic constraints, maybe we should tone down this concept of implementing pilot studies, which is a very basic and foundational idea. Other methods that I've seen also in the literature is when they base the number of samples on geographic area. For example, looking at the number of samples needed to effectively, and when I say effectively, to effectively estimate or precisely estimate relative abundance of, let's say, fish species, and having that relationship be associated with reservoir size. Well, it's not a function of reservoir size. It's an actual function of the sample variation that you're trying to estimate with your sample size. So, and instead of pushing on this idea of estimating the number of samples that one needs to be able to precisely estimate that abundance based on variation, they're now showing these linear regression relationships in which you basically plug in the size of your reservoir, and that produces the sample size estimate that you may need to develop your biological program around. And that's essentially not true, because it's a function of habitat within that reservoir and where that population in terms of the habitat that it's using and that spatial structuring and how variable the population is that you're sampling. So if habitat is uniform, you shouldn't see a lot of variation, and the species are using that habitat all around the reservoir, you shouldn't see variation to be extreme.
So imagine you're going to invest $100,000 to figure out how abundant a fish is in a reservoir. You don't know the variability of that fish where you're sampling. You're going to just go in blind and do it. You're rolling the dice to see whether or not you're going to have enough samples, and if at the end you're going to have anything really robust to say about that population.
Exactly, and that's really important, probably investing maybe one solid year of surveying to be able to get a really good estimate of what the population mean is, the variation is, so that way in the following years you can develop a sound biological program with the appropriate sample size estimates.
Matt, do you think these pilot studies, these preliminary studies to understand variability are important? Have you encountered folks that try to bypass that step?
Of course they're important. I mean, if you don't do them, you know nothing about how variable your population is, and therefore you can't get an idea of appropriate sample sizes. Yeah, people like to bypass them, but what I've found is that oftentimes they'll just go ahead and implement a survey with some gut feeling of sample size. You know, they might use some idiotic rule of thumb of, well, I need X number, and then implement their survey. And what I've done in the past is then I'll take that first year of information, basically treat it like a pilot study, and come back and inform them that, well, guess what, guys? You probably need 3, 4, 5 times the sample size you started with, which usually makes them unhappy, but it's the reality that they face. And if they want to get a reasonably precise estimate, they need to take the advice.
Randy, when I was going through stats classes many years ago, I remember there was much discussion about a target sample size of 30. Does that still hold, or do you have any perspectives on that?
I don't think there is a cut and dry estimate that one should lean on when developing their biological program, because it's not necessarily 30. It's based on the variation around that 30. I think if we set a value at 30, that's the minimum sample size that everyone should at least shoot for. That target, I think, is too low. That target should vary by the system being the population of interest.
Next time, we'll dive into this reservoir of wildlife biology topics that we've all dealt with to determine sample size in a real-world context.
So thank you for listening to Wildlife by the Numbers. We hope you enjoyed it and maybe even learned something. I'm Matt Butler.
Grant Harris.
Randy Stewart.
And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.